Hello, listener. Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, goodbye. From me, Stephen Fielding, one of the co-presenters, as you will know, being our loyal listener, of the Zeitgeist Tapes, which I co-present with my co-presenter. What's your name?
Emma Burnell.
Emma Burnell, yes. And we've just been doing it. I've just calculated that we've done about over 40 of these. So, no, that was performatively.
Right.
I was pretending in order to build up the tension and then have a comic moment. It wasn't the fact that I'm slowly going over the edge during this lockdown and forgetting some of the more basic things in my life. So, Emma, welcome, Emma. Yes, Emma's in her pied-à-terre in delightful South London. It is
East
South London, isn't it?
Northeast London.
Is it? I've been to my flat.
It's definitely north of the river, and it's got an E postcode.
But apart from that, it's got all the ambiance of South London, hasn't it?
How dare you, sir?
Yeah, not being from London and only very briefly lived in London, I really don't get all this kind of northeast, southwest kind of shenanigans.
Accuse me of living in West London.
I never would have done that. That's two mistakes I've made already, two lapses.
But you don't know who I am or where I live. Now, the question is, Steve, do you know who you are and where you live?
Yeah, I know who I am because we're doing this on Zoom and it's got my name on it. So that's always useful, just in case, which I could have used with you. But anyway, despite that very unprofessional, or actually that was quite a professional introduction for me. Welcome, listener. If you're still with us, you might have just disappeared at this point.
Sure they're not.
Yeah, I feel like I'm drunk and yet I'm not drunk. So anyway, this could be an interesting podcast. Yes, listener, if you're still with us, stay. Today on the Zeitgeist Tapes, we are going to look at a film that we might normally not have talked about. It's not overtly political with a big P, but it is political with a small P and was taken as such when it was first released. We're talking about The Stepford Wives, which was released in 1975. And based on an Ira Levine novel of the same name, which was published in 1972. And Levine has written wrote loads of novels that were all turned into films. I think his most famous one was Rosemary's Baby. And The Stepford Wives is I'd say it was darkly comic horror film. It's got numerous elements because there's a conspiracy in it as well. And there is what is an arguably, and I stress the word arguably a feminist, not even subtext, but a text, I think, which, you know, the listener might remember, depending on how old he, she or it is, that the early 1970s was a big, big moment for second wave radical feminism in the United States. And I think we need to see The Stepford Wives as part of that, even though it's directed by the British director, Brian Forbes, who largely rewrote it as well. So it's a kind of a British, you know, version, although it's very loyal to the novel. And also that Brian Forbes was, and I know this because I've seen the archives, in the early 1960s, when Brian Forbes was pitching to do a Churchill biopic, the Churchill people said, "We want him to do this because he's one of those very few people in the film industry who is right wing, right?" So Brian Forbes, probably was a liberal conservative, weren't they all in those days? But The Stepford Wives, to get back to The Stepford Wives, is a story of a family moves from the city, New York, to a lovely, lush, glorious upper middle class suburb. Somewhere, I don't know where it's meant to be, but in commuting distance from New York. So the husband in the family can commute to New York to do his work, leaving his wife and family in this lovely, idealistic kind of suburb. And then things start to happen. I'm not sure. I think we're going to have to, in the end, reveal what happens.
Yeah, as always, in Zeitgeist Tapes, there will be spoilers. We're discussing the entirety of the piece of work. You can't do that without spoilers, particularly in this kind of film. So anyone who hasn't seen it, pause the podcast now and then go off and get one of the last DVDs available, because we got the last two out of three, I think.
Yes, we were forced to buy the DVD on Amazon, because neither Amazon Prime or Netflix, unaccountably, have got this film available.
Stream it.
Yes, I mean, it was remade a few years ago. No, I mean, yeah, I've not seen it. Did you see that, Stan?
Oh my God, I hated it so much.
As I understand it, they heightened the comedy element of the Stepford Wives.
They heightened the comedy, they changed the ending, and by changing the ending, they took all the power away, really, of the of the message of the original film.
Right. So the message, I mean, this, and so we might as well get to the nub of the issue, what the message might be. I mean, first of all, I should say, I mean, you might as well get it out of the way, I really liked this film. I thought that there was so much tension in it. You know, there was a sense of inevitability, but you weren't quite sure how it was really going to end. But I thought, I mean, Brian Forbes was really a kind of humdrum. He wasn't an auteur. Yeah. He was a director and writer who did the job. And in this case, he did a really good job, I think. I mean, what did you think?
I mean, I agree. I've loved this film since I was, I think in single digits. It was one of the early films that my parents taped off the telly when we had a video. And it was made the year I was born, but I definitely saw it, I think, before I was 10, and I've watched it several times over my lifetime. Yeah, this is what happens when you're a second wave feminist, raised by a second wave feminist, is that your early influences are the Women's Room and the Stepford Wives. I mean, it's interesting because reading back on some of the controversy around it, feminists were not of one mind, but not that keen on the film as a whole when it came out, though it's been reappraised since. So it wasn't universally loved by the feminist community, but for me, I've always found it... I mean, maybe it's quite an interesting thing. I think there are two things about it that I take away on the opening thing that I think. One is that the term Stepford Wife has become a way to denigrate a certain type of woman. And actually that's annoying because, you know, these women have not chosen. The whole point of the woman, the lifestyle that these women are living, is they haven't chosen to be like this, and that actually there's a lot more debts even to a housewife, possibly, you know, amazingly enough. And the other thing is that I don't think this is a film necessarily about women. I think this is a film about how men view women, and there's so little discussion of that, and the simple idea that we've taken away this idea of this robo-wife as a Stepford Wife, and that's the takeaway of the film, is for me completely missing the point.
Mm. No, I mean, I think maybe for the listeners' sake, just for briefly run through the plot, which is that the family moves into this lovely suburb and the wife doesn't really want to go. And it turns out that that's actually quite a common pattern, that the men are the ones that are moving into this suburb and bring their wives somewhat reluctantly in, and there's a men's club which seems to sort of involve all the men and none of the women, as you might expect, and that slowly but surely this emerges through the film. These women, who's previously independent, you know, got their own views, you know, they are married, they are housewives, but they're independent sentient beings, are slowly turned into, I mean, robots. I mean, literally robots.
Yeah, and it's not slowly. What happens is after 4 months, see Joanna going through the process without knowing it. So she has her portrait painted by a very famous artist who lives there. She has her voice taken as part of a hobby project of a guy with a stammer. So they've got all these samples of who she is. And then they are, at 4 months, they are removed for a weekend in some way. So Bobby, who's Joanna's best friend, is going off for her annual weekend bonkathon with her husband. And when she comes back, instead of being the scruffy dungarees wearing
kooky
whiskey drinking kooky wonderful Bobby, yes. She yes. is wearing a pinny and a full length skirt and is only interested in giving Joanna a coffee and acting like the most perfect housewife.
Yes, she's got a clean kitchen, perfect hair, or hair that would be defined as, you know, perfect in, at that time. Bigger breasts. And as we know from other examples, she will have an ecstatic sexual response to her husband and see him in, you know, as a god, essentially, and her only function is to please him. And you can see that happening through a number of other examples. And obviously, Joanne is worried that that's going to happen to her. And literally, they are turned into robots. I mean, the real women are murdered and then replaced by these animatronic robots. I mean, there's obviously, actually, there's quite a, well, when I was going to say, there's a few examples, but, you know, there's Westworld. There's a few things flying around at this particular time with that. But the really funny bit, and I think the one of the satirical aspects of this is the guy who's called Diz, who's the man that seems to be in charge of the men's association. He is responsible for the robots at Disney World or Disneyland. I mean, they were quite famous in their times. Like,
yeah.
There was a thing about presidents, and they're all
yeah.
Yeah, Baudrillard wrote something very clever all about it. So it's quite funny, the connection with Disney as well. And we know that Disney, certainly at that time, was promoting certain kinds of idealised notions of what it is to be a woman and a man and all that kind of stuff, having just supervised a really good PhD on that subject about princesses. Literally they're murdered and replaced by a robot to the great satisfaction of the men. The men basically, and that's why it's, you're right, it's how you could see it as being anything other than this, I don't know, but I wasn't a feminist in the early 1970s. It's a film that is criticizing men's desire for these robotic, idealized women. I mean, not literally outside of the movie and the novel, but within the film. But it's kind of making a point about men's desires and how ridiculous they are in the real world.
And the plausibility of the horror. I mean, a horror film, you know, has to be able to be plausible to be scary. And while this is blackly comic, it is also scary. You know, there's genuine dramatic tension as we watch Joanna kind of gradually work out what's going to happen to her, and then watch it happen to her and watch her turn into at the end and, you know, walking through the supermarket as one of these robots.
I mean, I was surprised how tense I felt when I watched it. I don't know if that's anything to do the lockdown or the film or both, but I was gripped by it. I mean, and towards the end, when you're not quite sure what's going to happen, you know, it's like, oh God, you know, do I want to watch this? But it might be useful for the listener if we show, not show, but have a little clip. And this is when, I mean, Joanna, she knows what's going on now. She knows what's going on and she wants to move. And her husband at the husband says,
"She doesn't know the whole truth, but she's
no. She doesn't know the whole truth, but she's clocked what's going on
because she says, doesn't she? I may be going mad, and if I'm not, that's worse."
Yeah. There's. I mean, at one point, her and Bobby think it might be in the water that's changing these women. They're not sure what's going on, but these women are being changed into these doll-like, you know, figures. And so, husband agrees. Yeah, we'll move. Although, of course, he doesn't really agree because he's part of the conspiracy, because it is also a conspiracy film, which lots of conspiracy films at this time. He agrees, but says, but you need to go and see a shrink because we've only just moved to this place. So I don't want another 4 months when we move somewhere else, you're going to say it again. Because ostensibly she sounds mad. I mean, she does sound, you know, it's just crazy what she's saying. So this is, she finds her own psychiatrist and she outlines her concerns. So this is the clip.
The men are behind it.
What men?
All of them. All of them in the association. My husband. Everyone. The women don't. Can't abide and step for loving housework.
They change once they get there. I think the men make them change.
How would they do that? I don't know. They... Oh, Jesus. It's so awful. If I'm wrong, I'm insane. And if I'm right, it's worse than if I'm wrong. I don't know what they do exactly. They draw our pictures, and they tape our voices, and the women all look neat and pretty. There's a man, he's a druggist, he runs the pharmacy. And he's nothing, but his wife is just breathtaking. And once, by mistake, I happened to hear them making love, and she was carrying on incredibly, like he was some kind of God's gift. And Charmaine changed in 4 months and ripped up her tennis court. And Bobby, my best friend, changed in 4 months. And that's what convinced me. That's how long I've been in Stepford, 4 months. And I don't know what's going on. I just know something's wrong and my time is coming.
Terribly frightened, aren't you? Can you sleep? Well, that's easy. We can take care of that. And we'll see a lot of each other and you can talk some more. See, it's unfortunate, but I have to go away for a couple of days. It's something I can't put off at this short notice. But when I'm back, we'll talk.
No!
No, you don't want to talk or what?
I won't be here when you get back, don't you see? It's going to happen before then. Don't ask me to explain it. I just know. There'll be somebody with my name, and she'll cook and clean like crazy, but she won't take pictures, and she won't be me. She'll be like one of those robots in Disneyland.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really powerful. The, you know, and the sense of panic that she knows that she's about to disappear. And what was interesting was the she won't go without her kids, and that's what gets to her. Because if she'd just driven straight from that psychiatrist into hiding, she knows the kids won't under any physical threat because all the children still live and are raised by these robo moms, and that's an interesting question in and of itself.
What happens to them?
They just want the robo moms.
Yes.
But she goes back for her children, tries to offer her husband to be fair to her. Sadly, doesn't quite succeed. Then it tries to rescue her kids, and it's in the act of rescuing her children that she is cornered and killed.
Yes. And one of the scariest things about, because watching it, and it was, you know, generated in the early 1970s, and there were lots of Hollywood conspiracy films of this time. It's usually about politics or something to do with corporations, you know, related to the Vietnam War, JFK's assassination, Watergate, you know, things like that. So this is kind of a conspiracy film about gender and about how do men kind of dominate women?
What is the patriarchy if not a conspiracy of men against women?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it is a film about the patriarchy. It's a fantasy film about the patriarchy. But the scariest thing about the film is, because usually in conspiracy films, the conspiracy is thwarted, you know, it's discovered, you know, the hero manages to, you know, expose everything and saves the day, blah, blah, blah. Whereas all the scariest ones, like the parallax view, which is almost contemporaneous with this, is that when the person who's doing the investigating and it's all falling into place and you can see how it's starting to make sense. And at the very end, they know what's going on and then that's it.
Yeah.
They're subsumed within it. They're defeated. The conspiracy continues.
What's fascinating is the very, very ending of this. And you're looking at Joanna as she goes through the supermarket, and in the background, you see the newest moved in couple, and you know that because it's been seeded by a former star of the Zeitgeist tapes, who played Mrs. Schumacher in Dirty Dancing, the old biddy who runs the local paper.
Oh, Mrs.
Schumacher from Dirty Dancing.
Oh, was it? Right. Okay, didn't realise that.
Anyway, that's just an aside. But she tells us, seeds the idea that there's this new couple coming to town and they're the first black people in Stepford.
Yes, the first black people.
First of all, what's fascinating, and then you see them arguing in the background, and what they're arguing about is him spending every night at the Men's Association. And I think that does two things. First of all, it perpetuates the horror. You know that the horror is ongoing. This is going to keep happening and nothing is going to stop it. And secondly, it seems to make an argument, which is quite interesting, that the patriarchy exists even within, within other races. Now, it doesn't have an intersectional argument, because the woman in that couple would probably have, double discrimination, but it's very, I thought it was interesting that the argument of the film is this is the strongest power structure.
Yes. Yeah, I didn't really appreciate that point so much. I thought it was just to highlight, this is a very upper middle class, probably very Republican, very likely sort of suburb. But I don't know if you noticed that Bobby, Joanne's best friend, the one that precedes her in terms of being transformed or being turned into a robot, she's got an anglicised Jewish name. So she's already being conformed. She's already conforming. And obviously Ira Levine was Jewish, and I don't know if he made anything of it in a novel. But I think what that shows, I mean, it's this sort of this widespread notion about suburbs, cities and suburbs.
Yeah.
That cities are these kind of, and particularly New York, and especially at this time,
yeah,
when things were going gangbusters, as people used to say, in terms of, whatever was going on in New York, they're sites of anarchy, but creativity, goodness. And the suburbs are, there's a big difference, between the noise of the city and the quiet of Stepford. That's emphasised.
And it is the height of white flight, isn't it? Because what's been fascinating in the most recent sort of decade or so is actually the suburbs and the change in the suburbs in America. And that's pretty much what happened that helped the Democrats to win in Georgia.
Yeah. Different people are now moving into those suburbs. But I think there's a long-standing view. And I think it's entrenched certainly on the left and clearly in both United States and in Britain, that the suburbs are these hearts of conformity, this is one example in terms of how women are turned into, they're all very conformist in that regard.
And it's absolutely why I insist that, even though I live in zone three, I'm definitely inside the North Circular because I have all that ingrained in me. I'm a city girl. I don't want to be living in the suburbs. God forbid.
Oh yeah, I'm from a suburb. Just on the edges of Manchester, and I now live in Manchester in effectively a suburb, but it's still in Manchester. It's a different kind of a suburb because of that. But those are very strongly entrenched views, and it comes out in the film. I mean, in the sense that cities are dangerous, but they are challenging. I mean, that's why the husband wants to leave. He wants to leave New York, because right at the start of the film, Joanne is, who is a kind of semi-professional photographer, she starts, as they're leaving, she sees this rather bizarre scene of a tall man, a short guy, and a guy that's got a naked female mannequin. And she takes photographs of it because it's, a really interesting, very strange scene. And one of her daughters says, when her father turns up into the car, "Oh, Daddy, we just saw a naked lady." And he said, "Yes, that's why we're leaving.
Yeah.
And we're going to Stepford." And it's interesting, when she's in Stepford and she doesn't quite realise what's going on, and everything's really quiet, and the husband's got a quiet home, and she doesn't know anybody, and she's kind of slowly dying inside. When she takes photographs, they're no good. She's lost her creativity.
Yeah,
and it's only when... when Bobby goes off to her fatal weekend, but nobody knows that at this point, and she looks after her children, that the house is now chaotic. It's, it's full of kids, and the husband doesn't know what to do. He's completely, he's hopeless in this. He clearly doesn't like it. But she starts taking photographs of all these children being, playful and whatever, and lively. And those actually get lots of you know, she takes them to a gallery and they're great. Everyone thinks they're great because she's got a creativity back because of the anarchy and the liveliness and the disruption. Whereas the suburb and, you know, Stepford is obviously an exaggeration of it, is dead, quiet, looks lovely. And it's shot really, you know, it's always sunny. It's really, really, really colourful. And it's done in that kind of exaggerated way. And it's dead, but it's dead, you know. And so what literally these men are killing their wives to create a dead-eyed model who's got big breasts, thinks they're all sex gods, and they're happy. Although, did you not notice, right, at the start when they sort of move in, her husband, he goes to the men's association club for the first time and he's crying and he's sitting late at night and he's clearly worried or he's got concerns and he says to her, I love you. And because he clearly knows what's going to happen and he's accepting it. And but he doesn't, you know, I think that's the only example of men in this film not being complete and utter bastards and part of the patriarchy. I mean, he's being inducted into it, maybe.
Didn't and the chemist is that they go to is an ex-boyfriend, but he tries to shag her despite being married, doesn't he? So.
Yeah, yes, and he's not even in Stepford. And because he's married and she's now married, and he basically, yes, as you say, he tries to, the one that's testing the water, tries to, you know, set something up. Yes, he wants to test the water as well, but yes, that's very clever. Yes. So even outside of Stepford, men aren't great. But there's that little chink of kind of light there for a husband going, because he clearly doesn't like it, but he goes, in the end, he clearly goes along with it. And he's, you know, he's more than happy for his wife to be murdered. That's the price. That's the price she pays. Sorry?
You see him sat in the car waiting for Robo Joanna.
Oh, yeah.
So he's clearly happy as Larry with it all.
Oh, he's on board with it, but he's got a brief moment of regret when he knows that his wife is going to be murdered for the sake of creating a highly sexualized robo version of her. So so I'm not saying he's an angel or anything, but yeah, what I'm trying to wonder is why would some feminists have seen that film, or at least maybe they didn't even see it, they just heard about it, which might have been the thing. I'm assuming that some feminists didn't like it because of, in the end, it's hopeless for women. Women are trapped. You know, there's no agency. In the end, Joanna, Diz, when she comes in to confront him towards the end, he just takes that big knife off her, doesn't he? She lets him.
I think in part it was, it wasn't strong enough. It wasn't angry enough. I think it's been reappraised as both of those things, but at the time, it wasn't particularly militant, and in that context of the times, when you've got things like the Scum Manifesto being discussed very seriously, it didn't fall to the more extreme end of that scale, Possibly, it's very accessible. We've been having discussions recently about whether films with political messages can also be accessible if they have to be dull as ditch water.
Naming no names, Ken Loach.
But I think that it probably just was kind of a victim of falling slightly between the populist and the feminist stalls. Mm. And I think, as I say, I'm a huge part of the reappraisal. I've loved it all my life. And I think it was reappraised fairly soon, but it just, there's always going to be dissenting voices because the joy of feminism, as anyone who's ever been to a feminist meeting knows, is we don't agree on everything just because we're 50% of the population.
I mean, I'm very sure because we talked about Miss America, that's the TV series that traced Miss about America. You know, feminists and anti-feminists in this very period in the early sort of 1970s. And I very much doubt that Phyllis Laffley, the huge anti-feminist in Miss America, you know, right-wing Republican, real person, I doubt very much she would have like that film, because it was basically, because what it was doing was saying her vision of what, you know, idealized vision of what it was to be a woman was, in fact, these women are all robots, you know. But it was highly critical of that as an ideal, the film.
But I think what
bless you.
Some of the more radical feminists would say is, it's not either or.
Yeah. So the politics were quite, you know, as you say, though. I mean, as I say, Brian Forbes, not exactly a radical. I don't know what the original source material was. Maybe William Goldman, who actually wrote the script, but then it was all changed. The ending might have been slightly different. But the end, I mean, the ending.
I think the ending is the most feminist part.
Well, but she kind of just gives up, doesn't she? She submits to being murdered by the robo, her robo version in the end.
Sorry, I mean the very ending, the scary.
Yeah. Yeah, but even so, that means there's no escape. It's just, you know, that we know that that black woman in 4 months' time, because that seems to be the time period it takes, she'll be.
I think it would be an hop out if she'd won, because there is no escape from the patriarchy, or at least there isn't at the moment, and certainly not without.
And there wasn't in the 1970s. Fair enough. No, that's a fair enough conclusion. But maybe some feminists wanted agency in it to show that this is how you could do it. I don't know, but certainly it was. Would have not been on Phyllis Lafley's watch list or that of Richard Nixon, I suspect.
No.
In the White House, if he was just about still in the White House in 1975, I think. I don't know. Got anything else to say about this? But I mean,
it's so watchable. The other thing
is,
in terms of a piece of film, it's just it has such great pace. Such great story, fascinating cameo. Nanette Newman, just sort of.
Yeah, but the thing is, if you got Brian Forbes as director, you got Nanette Newman.
Yeah. No, she was married to him. But even so, I think she plays it really well.
She does, but ironically, I have very strong memories of Nanette Newman advertising Fairy Liquid, where she's kind of being one of a Stepford wifey kind of
character. Advert they say they do for free, isn't it?
Yeah, so that's a bit ironic, maybe. Yeah. But I mean, she's an actor, so she's playing a part of a robot. So she plays it really well, because I didn't realise she was a robot until quite late on. So it's a definite thumbs up.
Was this the first time that you'd seen it?
I remember seeing it once a long time ago, and the ending, I always knew that the ending she became part of it, but didn't know she was a robot.
Right.
So I got the right ball part, but I misremembered the end.
Right.
But I didn't remember it being a particularly great film, but it is. I think this is one of the best films I've watched this year. It's only 2 months. Maybe we'll extend that to the lockdown.
I mean, I'm a massive fan of Catherine Ross. Catherine Ross is in 3 of my favourite films, this being one of them.
What, the other two? Butch Cassidy?
Butch Cassidy and The Graduate.
Oh, The Graduate, yes. Yeah, I always forget she's in The Graduate. Anyway, so listener, yes, it's on Amazon. You have to buy the DVD. If you get the DVD, watch it, please, and let us know what you think. And I think on that bombshell, we can draw this. It started off badly. I was getting everything wrong. I think I've recovered now. I'll be going out my bike in the sunshine after this as well. So everything's looking up now. So all it behoves me to do is to thank Emma.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank myself. Thank you, Steve. And to also thank Lord Stuart Wood for the theme tune, to remind you that this is a Political Human production, and on whatever platform you may be listening to this, why don't you rate us?